Okay, so let us start the talk for tonight, and we'll see what happens as we go along. And the topic for tonight's talk is samadhi. Samadhi meaning the deep states of meditation that are available on the Buddhist path, and that are a very important part of the Buddhist path. And I want to talk a little bit about the significance of these things. Are they really important? Can they be skipped? Are they dangerous? And these sort of things. And this is actually a very important topic in Buddhist and meditation circles around the world. For those of you who may not be aware of that, if you are maybe slightly new to Buddhism or something, one of the kind of eternal debates is about this balance between insight on the one hand and samatha, calm, on the other hand. And samadhi is that calm taken to a very, very profound state. The jhanas you will have heard Ajahn Brahm talk about. So how important are these things? Is it something that we should aim for? How should we deal with these profound states of meditation? And you may have heard, if you have listened to Ajahn Brahm, then you may have been brainwashed into seeing the importance of these things. Ajahn Brahm always talks about samadhi. Yeah, jhanas, 1, 2, 3, 4. Beyond that, this is kind of Ajahn Brahm's, one of his specialities. I don't know about you, but I have been living with Ajahn Brahm for 25 years. And I sort of know him very well, and I trust his understanding of these things, because he is one of those meditation masters, really, in the kind of modern era, really. So here, that's Ajahn Brahm on the one hand. We have these this side, but then you have the other aspects, other types of meditation, which do not emphasize samadhi in the same way. So the question then arises: How do we look at this? There was a talk, I believe, here at Amaloka during the rains retreat, where they talked about maybe samadhi wasn't so important. I got an email the other day, someone saying, this samadhi doesn't really matter. Isn't it dangerous? Isn't it full of attachments and all these kind of things? Of course, if you're going to decide on these issues, is it good? Is it bad? Does it lead to attachment or not? You have to have some kind of grounding, some kind of standard by which you decide these things. And that standard must always be the word of the Buddha. That is the one thing every one of us, all Buddhists, every meditators who are drawn to Buddha center have in common. That is where this entire tradition comes from, the word of the Buddha. Everything else is kind of uncertain, but the word of the Buddha, that is the foundation stone that we rely on. Otherwise, Buddhism doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So what does the Buddha have to say about samadhi? And one of the astonishing things is, if you ever read some of the suttas, if you ever read the word of the Buddha, and I would really recommend you to read this sometimes, it's very, it can be very, very inspiring, very beautiful, wonderful similes in there, nice little metaphors that the Buddha uses. It's very profound and very beautiful at the same time. So I really would recommend, start with something easy like the Dhammapada, book of verses, and then kind of take it from there. There's so much food for the heart, as one of Ajahn Chah's, Ajahn Brahm's teacher's books is called, in those suttas. So what do they say? And what they say is that you can open up almost any random page. This is, suttas are about 5,000 pages. You can almost open up any random page, look at that sutta, and the chances that you find samadhi in there are very high. Why? Because it is such a fundamental part of the Buddhist teachings. It is everywhere. You can't really miss it. So this is one of the low-hanging fruits of reading the suttas. One of the things you get pretty much straight away here. You understand the importance of the jhanas and samadhi here. So this is kind of the one of the benefits of reading the suttas. You gain that independence of view, whereby you can understand what is going on. That's great to feel independent. Always being dependent on others is always feels a bit dangerous. So gaining some independence is always extremely useful. And it's not just that you read it wherever you kind of look in the suttas, you find things about samadhi. If you look at one of the key teachings of the Buddha, just before the Buddha was about to pass away, he was telling his monks, this is my teaching. What is the Buddha's teaching? And the Buddha said, my teaching, the thing you should remember, the thing you should carry on, memorize and practice for future generations. How can that be summarized? And it can be summarized in what is called the 37 aids to awakening. The entire teaching of the Buddha can be summarized into the 37 aids to awakening. And if you look at those 37 aids, there's a number of factors in there. There are three things that are found in many and numerous times among those 37 things. One is mindfulness. Yeah, you would expect that Buddhism kind of specializes in mindfulness. Yeah, this is where the whole mindfulness movement comes from around the world. It comes from Buddhism originally. It has to do with effort. Effort is another one that you see a lot of. Yeah, effort, very important. And the last one is samadhi. Yeah, it is a fundamental core aspect of the teaching of the Buddha. It is right there among his most basic teachings. He summarizes the path. Samadhi is one of the most important things. And one of the little suttas that I remember reading many, many years ago, it talks about like the four characteristics of Buddhism. Yeah, the Dhamma, what are these four characteristics? And one of them is non-ill will, non-anger. Yeah, it's kind of an obvious one. It's very anti-spiritual to be very angry. One of them is non-desire, being content with life, not being too kind of accumulative and these kind of things. The other one is mindfulness. Again, you would expect that because such an important thing, mindfulness, meditation and all that. The last one is samadhi. These are the four kind of foundations of what Buddhism is about. So what this means is that when we talk about samadhi, not only is it important, it is absolutely fundamental. It is a crucial aspect of this path. And without it, what you're doing is that you are taking away something which is fundamental to the Buddhist teachings. And when you do that, it means that you will not be able to reach the end of the path. You will not be able to reach the beautiful results of insight, of peace or calm that this path actually promises you. That's how important it is, absolutely fundamental to Buddhism. So to look at this from another point of view, I'm going to talk a little bit about Sammata and Vipassana. Because this is a topic which is very closely related to Samadhi, deep meditation. Sammata is calm. Yeah, this is what one aspect we're trying to do in meditation. And Vipassana is often translated as insight. But actually, it is probably better to translate as clear seeing. You see things clearly, you're not confused, you don't have a mind which is all over the place. And these two words, these have become methods of meditation practice in the modern Buddhist world. People practice samatha meditation, calm meditation, or they practice vipassana meditation, insight meditation. And these are kind of two strains almost of meditation practice in the Buddhist world. Calm on the one hand, insight a clear seeing on the other hand. And this is really problematic already because it means that you get a conflict in the world where some meditators do one thing. We are the real path. You guys, you don't know what you're talking about. This is the real path. This leads to insight. You guys, you're just practicing calm. What's the point of having calm? Insight is the real deal. This is what life is about, seeing things clearly. The whole Buddhist teaching is about seeing things according to reality. Understanding life, understanding the mind and these kind of things. And it's true, isn't it? This is what Buddhism ultimately is about. And this is part of the problem. Because once you divide the practice into samatha and vipassana in this way, the vipassana part, because that is about insight, about wisdom, understanding, it becomes very attractive. This is what Buddhism, of course, is about. So everyone should be practicing vipassana, right? To get to the core of what Buddhism is about. Forget this kind of calm business. Who needs calm if you can have real insight? And this is a problem. So you get a clash in understanding, and you get a clash in, and there's a tendency to elevate the vipassana practice, the insight practice, over the calm practice. And it's a big, big problem because that is not how the Buddhist path works. Let's just have a look at some of the things that define vipassana or insight meditation. So one of the things that define insight meditation is that very often you start off with mindfulness of breathing. So you start off with a degree of calm anyway. What Ajahn Brahm teaches is mindfulness of breathing is a very calming and soothing meditation. So this is the first thing that the vipassana movement usually teaches. They teach a degree of calm anyway. It's already part of the practice. And depending on how far you take it, it is more or less equivalent to what we call samatha practice. So this is one of the things about vipassana. It already includes a lot of calm in it already. The other thing, which is, to my mind, the biggest problem with Vipassana practice, is that it is usually not based on the word of the Buddha. Yeah, it is based on things that were written a long time after the Buddha. Vipassana is usually based on the Abhidhamma. Abhidhamma is this kind of philosophical compendium that was written down maybe a few hundred years after the Buddha. That is a very important part of what insight meditation works. It is based on the Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga is the one thing that maybe defines Theravada Buddhism more than anything else. It was written by a very famous Sri Lankan monk called Buddhaghosa about 1,000 years after the Buddha. Yeah, and modern meditation techniques are all based on that compendium of meditation written by Buddhaghosa long, long time after the Buddha. So to me, this is really problematic, because if we are basing our meditation systems on things that are not the word of the Buddha, do we know that we're getting the real deal? Is this the way it's supposed to be? If this is so important, why didn't the Buddha teach these things? Surely the Buddha would have had the same kind of insights, the same understanding. Why didn't he teach these things if they are so important? And this, to me, it tells me always, it's always a bit worrying. Some of these techniques may be very valid, but there's always a danger there unless you base yourself on the word of the Buddha. This is really the critical thing here. So we have to ask ourselves always, what did the Buddha teach? What is the Buddha's method of meditation? How does he deal with samatha and vipassana? So to understand this, one of the critical elements of vipassana meditation or insight meditation that comes from the suttas is the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on Mindfulness Meditation, one of the most famous suttas probably in the world. Very, very famous sutta, and people who teach vipassana, they base themselves to a large extent on that sutta and then bring in the Abhidhamma and Visuddhimagga to back it up or to flesh it out, if you like. So from the vipassana point of view, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Mindfulness Meditation Sutta, if you like, the Buddha's word on mindfulness meditation, from the vipassana point of view, it's all about insight. It's all about seeing things clearly here. But then you go to the suttas. And what do the suttas say about Satipatthana? What the suttas say here, one of the ways of practicing Satipatthana is to watch the breath. And not only is it to watch the breath, but actually the watching of the breath takes you all the way to completing and fulfilling the Satipatthana practice. The point is, though, that watching the breath is considered a calm meditation. Yeah. So in the suttas, actually what they say is that when you practice Satipatthana, you're doing a calm kind of meditation. Whereas the later generation say when you practice Satipatthana, you are doing Vipassana meditation. So who is right? What is going on here? How can there be such an obvious clash? Surely everyone would have seen this already. So what is going on? And what is going on is that the fundamental difference between the suttas and later generations is that in the suttas, all meditation is about two things, both samatha and vipassana. These two things are not actually divisible. When you practice watching the breath, you become calm, but you also see more clearly at the same time. Calm and clarity, calm and insight always go together. They go hand in hand. They cannot really be separated out the way that things traditionally have been done in Buddhist circles. They should come together. Only then can you understand meditation properly. Why is that? Why do they have to go hand in hand? And actually, hand in hand, it's actually quite easy to understand, because the reason they go hand in hand is because when you practice, develop the Buddhist path, one of the core things that we do as we develop this path is to reduce the defilements of the mind. Yeah, we practice sila, we practice morality, we practice a reduction in anger and also in desires. We purify the mind. Now, what happens when you purify the mind? This is kind of the core element of Buddhism. What happens? It is that you become more calm. Yeah, if you have lots of desires and ill will, what happens to the mind is all over the place. It's running here, running there, it's restless, it's agitated. You can't really enjoy it at all. So if you reduce the defilements of the mind, you become more calm. But, and this is kind of the critical thing, if you reduce the defilements of the mind, you also see things more clearly. If you are really angry with someone, how much clarity have you got? you haven't got much clarity. Yeah, if you're angry, it's like you have a, you can't really see this person as they actually are because you have like a bias towards seeing them in a negative way because you're angry with them. Yeah, so when you are angry, there's no clarity there. When you're full of desires, also there is no clarity. When you're full of desires, you make all kinds of mistakes in life. You do things that you know you shouldn't be doing, and afterwards you regret it. So when you practice the Buddhist path in the right way, which is the reduction of defilements, which everything is about, being less angry, as I said before, the core aspects of Buddhism, less desire, less ill will, on top of mindfulness and samadhi. As you do that, you develop two things, samatha and vipassana, calm and clear seeing, always going together. And of course, when you start again reading the word of the Buddha, this is exactly what you see. When you read the word of the Buddha, they're always compounded with each other. Sammata vipassana occurred like one word, as if they are two aspects of the same thing. They always come together, not always, but like 80% of the time they come together as a compound. It's one word. It's called sammata vipassana, calm and clear seeing, together. Why? Because they cannot be separated in this way. So this is how the path works. So instead of thinking about the path in terms of vipassana or samatha, the way we should think about the Buddhist path, yeah, this is kind of one of the critical things that I want to talk about when it comes to meditation practice. The critical thing is to think about the Buddhist path as a way of purifying yourself. That is what it really is about. Yeah, so we should do whatever practice leads to greater purity, leads to a reduction in these mental defilements, leads to greater kindness, leads to greater compassion for the people around us, makes us more peaceful inside. When you do those things, that is when you know that you are practicing the Buddhist path. And the result of that is always twofold, samatha and vipassana, calm and clear seeing, calm and insight. So this is what you should focus on. Ask yourself, are your negative character traits, are they going down? Are your positive character traits, are they increasing? Are they expanding? Are they becoming bigger? Are you becoming more mindful? Are you becoming more still? Do you feel more kindness inside of you? How do you feel about people around you? Do you feel that you have more time for them? You have more compassion for them, more understanding? Or is it the negative qualities that are growing? Sometimes it's a bit like this. Yeah, it's a bit like a yo-yo. There's a kind of the mind is very kind of hard to control, of course. Don't really try to control it. We try to use wisdom instead. But the general trend should be one that goes in that direction. That is what we should focus on. So what are the practices that lead to that? That is the Buddhist practice. And of course, it includes everything, like the sila, the morality. It includes kind of restraining us, holding back a little bit. It includes the watching the breath. It includes thinking about life in the right way. This is so essential. Our outlook on the world is absolutely crucial for how we kind of move in life. What is important to us? What matters? Where do we put our effort and energy? Yeah, we remember how ephemeral all the things in the world are and how dangerous it is to attach to these things, because you're always going to get it's always going to get a black eye afterwards when those things kind of get taken from you by nature. Nature comes, takes back its own, and then you suffer as a consequence. Everything in the world is like that. So you start to turn inwards, the right outlook. All of these things coming together. Read the sutta so you understand the right outlook of Buddhism. And as you do this, then this beautiful process happens. It happens through meditation. It happens through reflection. It happens through conduct. Yeah, these are the core essential aspects of this Buddhist path. So as we do this, what happens? What happens? Your mind becomes more and more pure. Yeah, you may not believe this, but if I compare myself today to what I was 25 years ago, when I came here 25 years ago, you probably wouldn't recognize me. You think, who's that scallywag running around trying to wear white, pretending to be a monk, yeah? And one of the things that I have found so beautiful about this path is precisely that it changes you. Yeah, you look inside of yourself over 25 years and you can see the change inside of you, how actually you do become more compassionate, you do become more kind, you do become more at ease, you do have less of the defilements. Yeah, this is the beautiful thing. If that hadn't happened to me, there's no point in being a monk anymore. If this path doesn't work, might as well do something else which is more fun in life, going back and get a relationship or something like that. Actually, I wouldn't recommend that too much because If you recommend that as a monk, you are in trouble. So this is what keeps you in the game, when you see this change happening inside of you. And then it goes up and up and up and up. You become more and more purified. Your meditation becomes deeper and deeper, more and more profound. And as you do that, two things happen. Yeah, you become more calm. You have more clarity, more clear seeing. Yeah? These two things going together all the way. And eventually, as you move up to these things, there comes a point when you get to the kind of the highest level of calm, and that is where samadhi comes. Samadhi is a natural expression of purifying your mind. As you do that, there comes a point when the meditation becomes incredibly deep and profound. The world is shut off. All you feel is the most powerful bliss you've ever felt in your entire life. Yeah, and then you realize, jeepers, this is so... I don't know, this is so cool, is that the right word? I'm not sure. It's very good anyway. Yeah. But what also happens, because all the defilements are gone, when you come to that level, also you have the ability to see the world as it actually is, which is the real purpose of the Buddhist path. Samadhi and seeing things according to reality coming together. They're not separate things. You can't take them apart from each other. They come together as outcomes of this path. So which one is more elementary, samadhi, or seeing things according to reality? And the truth is that samadhi is more elementary. Deep meditation is more elementary. That comes first. Then comes the seeing things according to reality. Why is that the case? Because to enter samadhi, you have to give up a lot, but not as much as you have to give up when you see things fully according to reality. Samadhi is difficult to attain because you're giving up a lot. You are leaving so much of the world behind to be able to enjoy the stillness and the peace inside. Yes, but you haven't given up everything because you still have that bliss, that unity, that sense of, you know, being very powerful inside of you. But to have full insight into the nature of reality means that you see even that mind, even that beautiful mind, you understand it as non-self, as impermanent, as problematic. So you abandon even that ultimately. Buddhism is an extraordinarily profound teaching. It takes you to things that are just kind of absolutely mind-blowing, quite literally, because the mind is starting to disappear. Yeah, so literally mind-blowing, bang, no mind, everything gone, everything kind of beautiful. And so this is how the path works. And this is how the samatha vipassana, the samadhi and true insight always have to go together from the very beginning to the very end. Forget about this whole thing about samatha and vipassana meditation. It just leads to problems. Anything which reduces your defilements is both samatha and vipassana. That is what you should focus on. Then you will be on the right path, on the right track. But I want to come back to some of the things that people often mention when they talk about the dangers of samadhi practice, yeah? And one of those dangers that people often talk about is that you get attached to it. Imagine, I don't know, maybe some of you have had some really profound meditation. There's always some people who have had some really profound meditation, even in a room like this. And for those of you who have had these experiences, you know how extraordinarily attractive they are. The deeper you go in your meditation, the more bliss you feel, the more unified you feel, the more out of this world you feel, the more independent you feel of everything else. You feel just like this, I think Ajahn Brahm once said that, you feel like a nuclear reactor. Do you want to feel like a nuclear reactor? Is that good or bad? Well, he was just talking about the energy level. They had lots of energy. You're like a nuclear reactor with your energy. So you have so much energy. You have all of these remarkable things. And of course, it is very easy to get attached to that. So is that a problem? It's one of those things that we always talk about in Buddhism. Attachment to samadhi is dangerous. But actually, it is the wrong way of thinking about this. Because the point is that as long as you have a sense of self, yeah, and probably most people here have a sense of self, at least a little bit. As long as we have a sense of self, we're going to have attachments. We have no choice. When Buddhist people say, oh, I'm a Buddhist, I should be a good Buddhist, I must not have any attachments. They don't know what they're talking about. It's impossible to say, I must not have any attachments. It is a natural part and parcel of who we are. Attachments come with the, you know, comes with the five khandhas. You have to have attachments, no choice. So once you understand that you have to have attachments, the question only becomes, where do you attach? And of course, the vast majority of people in the world, they attach to the pleasures of the world, the people around them, the relationships and all of these kind of things, yeah? But the idea on the Buddhist path is to try to leave aside those lower attachments, because we know that they must lead to problems and things in the end. So we try to gradually move up what you might call the ladder of attachment, grasping on to a higher rung. And as you move up, you can start to let go of the lower attachments. You have no choice to attach anyway. There's going to have to be some attachment there. It's just a matter of what you attach to. Make sure you attach to something useful, something that actually makes you happy. Don't attach to stuff that kind of, it leads you to suffering and problems. So as you climb up this path, one of the highest kind of attachments that is possible to have in existence is attachment to samadhi. Yeah? Once you have attachment to samadhi, you have largely let go of all the lower attachments, and all you have left is this wonderful, astonishing thing in the mind, this mental liberation, this mental beauty, and you have some attachment to that. That is all that is left. And of course, this is a movement, is what it actually is. It's a gradual movement away from attachments until you reach the most subtle attachments that are possible. And what is so interesting about this is that the attachment that you have to samadhi is a much lighter kind of attachment than the attachment to the ordinary world. Yeah, because, and the reason for that is because as you go deeper on the path, you have more understanding, you have more insight. You have more clarity about how the world works. And because you have more clarity, you actually attach less. The grip isn't so strong anymore. So the attachment that you have when you come to samadhi actually is very light. It's not something very strong usually. So that is how you deal with these things. And that is the right way of thinking about attachment. The question still is, though, is there a problem, perhaps, with attaching to deep meditation? Is there any problem at all? And the answer to that, this is also answered in the suttas, in the word of the Buddha. And the Buddha says the only problem with attaching too much to samadhi is that it stops you from attaining samadhi. Yeah. Often people say, oh, you shouldn't practice samadhi because it leads to attachment. The Buddha says, no, the problem with attachment is not, it doesn't mean you should stop practicing it. What it means, it will hinder you in getting that samadhi you're trying to get. That is the real problem. That's why we should avoid attaching too much. Little bit of attachment, but not too much. Then you are on the right track. You avoid the attachment so as to enable you to practice this samadhi. That is the right attitude. That is the right way of thinking about this. I hope I'm making sense. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure whether I'm making, I try my best, but you know what it's like sometimes. So this is how the path of samadhi, attachment to samadhi, is to be looked at from the point of view of the suttas. There's nothing to be afraid of there. It is something to be undertaken. One of the other things about samadhi that people sometimes are afraid of, this is the idea that we become deluded by samadhi, that we take samadhi as some kind of real existence. Yeah, this is the real me, this is unity with God. One of the fascinating things is that, you know, some people who have read some of the ancient mystics in Christianity, Teresa of Avila was a famous Spanish nun, and she was one of the Christian mystics from the 16th, 17th century, something like that. When you look at how they explain their mystical practices, it is very similar to the results that we have in meditation practice, yeah? But of course, when they do that, they have a very different idea of these things, because for them, they have found God. Yeah, this is God. Surely this must be God. So happy. I feel completely unified with the world. There's no difference between me and everything else. It is all powerful. Yeah, this must be God. Yeah, so this is kind of a natural outcome of starting off with a God idea. Exactly the same thing in Hinduism. In Hinduism, you have the idea of Brahma, just another idea of God, really. You find Brahma. Yeah, this is Brahma. Yeah, it's so beautiful. It must be Brahma. So, but the Buddhist point of view is that instead of taking these things to be anything, because we start off with the right view, we start off with the Buddha telling us to be careful with these things. These things are impermanent. These things are non-self. Yeah, investigate these things, because we start off with a right view from the Buddhist point of view. we actually don't attach to those things when we get there, because we know the Buddha has already told us that these things are not God. Yeah, you have an experience. Well, okay, that's what it is. It isn't anything more than that. Whatever, if you think it's a God, you have added something to that experience, which actually is not inherent to the experience itself. It is something you are adding to it. So, from a Buddhist point of view, if you know how the Buddha teaches, there is no danger of being deluded by these things. Yeah, because you know that these things are to be transcended. You know we're supposed to go even deeper. You don't think that there is a God when you kind of get to these very profound states. On the contrary, you investigate even that and go beyond it. In fact, the idea that samadhi leads to delusion and leads to a misunderstanding of reality is the exact opposite of the truth. The whole point of samadhi is to come to a state where the hindrances, where all these delusions in the mind, all the things that give us a vested interest, all of these things are completely abandoned. That is the purpose of samadhi. Anything which deludes you is actually gone when you get to samadhi. There is a nice little sutta in the middle-length sayings of the Buddha called the Nalakapana Sutta, where the Buddha says that the point of samadhi is that these hindrances, these things that distract us and distort reality, they are only fully gone after you attain a deep state of samadhi, a jhana state. Only then are they completely gone. This tells you something again about why samadhi works, why it is so powerful. It is anti-delusion. It is not delusion. It's the opposite of delusion. That is what it really is about. So once you get that, you understand again the power of these things, why this actually leads to final insight. When samadhi is conjoined with right view and right outlook, it leads to only one thing. It leads to enlightenment. It leads to stream entry. It leads to profound insight in accordance with the reality. There's a nice sutta in the long discourse of the Buddha called the Pasadika Sutta. This is one of the first suttas Ajahn Brahm would quote to me when I became a Buddhist monk. Yeah, and then he brainwashes you again and again and again until you come up here and you talk just like Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, blah, 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 Ajahn Brahm, blah, blah, blah. And you say exactly the same thing as he says. Yeah, there's no difference anymore. You wonder why. And one of the ways that he brainwashed me was my, oh, not just me, but Sampa also is not as brainwashed as I am, but partly brainwashed as well, yeah, when there was Sampa over here, because that's what happens. It's a good brainwashing, yeah. Brainwashing is a positive thing in Buddhism because you wash out all the defilements and then you get on the right track, yeah. So make sure you get the right kind of brainwashing and then your business. So what the Buddha says in this particular sutta called the Pasadika Sutta, the delightful discourse, he says that the four jhanas, samadhi in its deepest level, only leads to one thing or to four things. Yeah, when the four jhanas are anuyutta, anuyutta means literally that you is almost like attaching to them. Yeah, when you hold on to these things and you practice them, it only leads to four things. Nothing except for four things. When you have right view and right outlook coming along, what are those four things? Stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arahatship, the four stages of enlightenment, the four stages of awakening. That's all it leads to, nothing else. It is a absolutely fundamental part of the most profound teachings of the Buddha, taking you all the way to enlightenment itself. Please don't think otherwise. If you do, you're going to go down the wrong track. These are essential things in the Buddhist path. The last thing I want to talk about very briefly, and that is, you sure you want to go now? This is getting really cool, yeah, towards the end here. Are you sitting at the back? Okay, good. So the last thing I want to talk about, sometimes people say that samadhi, too much happiness. Yeah, it's all just about indulging yourself. Yeah, you're happy, you know, and then you indulge, but that's not what Buddhism is about. Buddhism is about kind of, insight. Yeah, you have to be more tough in Buddhism, not kind of some slacker who kind of just indulges in happiness all the time. This is one of the criticisms that you sometimes hear. And this criticism is, again, from my point of view, very ill-founded. Yeah, it is. And one of the reasons why it is ill-founded is all the Buddhism is about happiness. You start reading the suttas and you see, well, why should we be virtuous? Why should we be kind to others? Because it makes us happy. Why should we be generous? Well, it's nice to others, of course, but also because it makes us happy to be generous. Yeah, people think generosity is like is for losers, but actually no, generosity is for winners because generosity makes you happy. Meditation makes you happy if you do it in the right way. Everything in Buddhism is geared towards more and more happiness. This is why the Four Noble Truths are the Noble Truth of Suffering. Yeah, because when you get suffering, you also get happiness. You understand. In other words, when you understand suffering, you also understand happiness. These things are two sides of the same coin, cannot really be separated at all. So happiness is fundamental on the Buddhist path. How can people say, too much happiness, yeah, do you need to be more, get more serious about this practice, all you do is indulging. No, it's good to indulge in the right kind of happiness if you know where to look for happiness. And one of the most beautiful suttas that I always teach when I come do meditation retreats, yeah, if you come on my weekend retreat, when was it? I can't remember when it was. When did it, was it, Dennis? It was one of these days it's coming up. I promise to teach this sutta, yeah? And this sutta is called Dependent Liberation in my translation. And Dependent Liberation shows the process of how the mind is liberated, starting from the beginning to the very end. And it shows the process as a felt experience. What does it feel like, this process? And what is so astonishing about this process is that the way the Buddha explains it, he starts off with virtue. From virtue comes non-regret, because if you are really virtuous, really kind, really compassionate, and all these kind of things, you have no regrets about your conduct anymore. From non-regret comes pamuja, gladness. From pamuja comes piti. Piti is like rapture, more powerful gladness. From the piti comes tranquility, the deep sense of stillness and peace. Sometimes you may have sat in meditation, but you may have felt incredibly peaceful and still. That's the pasadi. You don't want to get up anymore. You want to sit here forever. And then the caretaker comes and says, please go, because you can't be here forever. Has that ever happened here before, Lynn, that we have to chase people out? It has happened. You see, there you are. It does happen. Help them along, guys. Cool, yeah? That's really good. People are really enjoying themselves. And then from that tranquility, you get sukha. Even more happiness, because when the mind and the body become really tranquil, you feel a profound sense of happiness inside. This is the path, yeah? Happiness upon happiness upon happiness upon happiness, one after the other, one more powerful than the other, until you think you're going to explode with happiness. Have you ever had that feeling before? You're going to explode with happiness? This is what happens when you do this, yeah? It's good to explode with happiness. You don't actually explode. That feeling is good. Yeah, you just keep on going, and you actually really enjoy yourself. It is so beautiful. It is so powerful. When you read this, how can you fail to be inspired? You feel this is what everything I've been looking for my entire life. Everything I do is geared towards finding happiness in one way or another. I've just always been looking in the wrong place. I've been looking in relationships. I've been looking at having the right job. I've been looking at kind of doing a little bit of mindfulness meditation. Yeah, actually, you do find it when you turn in a different direction. You find everything you ever wanted, everything that you are doing now, that your mind is geared towards finding happiness, you find there in that sequence called dependent liberation, when meditation really works. And it's all about happiness, more and more profound. And then at the peak of that happiness, what happens? At the peak of that happiness, you get samadhi. Samadhi is this profound, deep state of meditation again. It comes from happiness. It's based on happiness. Yeah, why? Because happiness is the glue that keeps you to the meditation object. When you are really, really happy, you cannot fail to be absolutely one-pointed in what you're doing. Because what else are you going to do if you have found the highest happiness in your life? That's all that's going to be of interest to you. Everything else fades by comparison. That's why you want to be here. And guess what happens next? Once you have that samadhi, you have just experienced the highest happiness. Happiness that you didn't even think was possible in this world, perhaps. Yeah, you've experienced that. And the consequence of experiencing that happiness and stillness is what? Seeing things according to reality. That is where you see things according to reality. Without that samadhi, it is impossible to have that final insight that actually takes you and draws away the veil of existence, as it's called in the suttas, the veil whereby we always are slightly deluded, because a veil makes things blurry, you can't see things clearly. You draw away the veil, then you can see life as it actually is, based on samadhi. That is the requirement that is needed to actually get there. This is one of the most important teachings in the whole of the suttas. Well, that's an exaggeration. It is very important because it occurs in so many places, again and again and again. The Buddha says samadhi is the upanisa for yathabhuta jnanadasana. Samadhi, the profound stillness of the mind, is the proximate cause, or the kind of the foundational cause for seeing things according to reality. That is how important it is. And that hopefully should give you the encouragement to practice this. It is very beautiful. It's very, very powerful. It leads to all the most powerful things on the Buddhist path. Please don't throw these things out. Please don't think that there is an alternative vipassana path which is more powerful. Vipassana and samatha go together. If you practice in the right way, you will include the vipassana meditation and samatha meditation into one thing. All you have to do is practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Watch the breath, reflect in the right way, and then these things will happen as a consequence. One of the beautiful things that Ajahn Chah, many of you may have heard about Ajahn Chah, he was probably the most famous meditation master in Thailand in the 20th century, very, very famous. 500,000 people, I think, came to his funeral service. That's terrible, isn't it? It shouldn't become so famous because all these people have to suffer at your funeral service. Imagine 500,000 people coming together. Gee, that would be terrible. Ajahn Brahm was there. He kind of stayed in the background because it was too much suffering to be part of that enormous throng of people. Some people probably died, yeah? You go to the funeral service to learn something about spirituality and you die because you probably get trampled on by so many people. Probably what happens on these things. You kind of... kind of crazy, completely opposite of what it's supposed to be doing here. But those who survived, they had the benefit of Ajahn Chah's teachings. And one of the beautiful little sayings by Ajahn Chah that he taught, he said that we should come back to our real home. Our real home is not some external place. It is not a beautiful house. It's not a beautiful relationship. That's not what the real home is. The real home is when you close your eyes, you let go of the whole world outside, and you go inside of yourself, and you find all the bliss, all the stillness, all the beauty that exists in this world right there inside of yourself. That is your real home. You feel free from the world. You feel released. You feel independent. And you know that you're moving towards the highest happiness that is possible to attain in this life. So that, there you are. That is a little talk about samadhi for you, the importance of deep meditation. Okay. So, are there any questions? Yes, please. Okay, maybe if you want to repeat it for the microphone, would you mind doing that, just so people online can hear it as well?
What's the name of the sutta you mentioned?
Okay, so the place to find these suttas are mostly in the numerical discourses of the Buddha, the Anguttara Nikaya. Do you know these discourses? Do you know the names of these collections? There's a collection called the Numerical Discourse, one of the main collections of discourses by the Buddha, and these suttas are numbered from 1 to 11. Go to the tens, look at the first two or three or four suttas in the tens. They're all on that theme. There's many, many more also in the Anguttara, but that is one place where you will find them. Yeah, so check it out. And if I said anything wrong, please come back and tell me off. We'll sort it out. Okay, anyone else would like to ask anything here? Everyone is so happy. Yeah, did you get some good samadhi? Great, okay, so let's take some questions from outside of the center here. Yeah, thank you. Great. I got to get my glasses out, and I'm getting older, and can't see. I can see a blur. That's all I can see here. So, first one is from Poland. It is so nice that as a Buddhist society we can actually share these teachings with people around the world. I find it so inspiring, and you get people from everywhere being able to take part. It's a wonderful thing. So, hello Poland. Hello there. So, can you please talk a little of pre-Buddhist shaman and vipassana? So pre-Buddhist shaman ha and vipassana, something is missing there. Pre-Buddhist meditation was mostly meditation that was geared towards samadhi, especially the meditation that was done by the Brahmanism, which is the precursor to modern Hinduism, because they wanted to find unity with Brahma. So because of that, it was mostly a samadhi kind of meditation practice that they did. And there is some remnants of that in the suttas. You find that there. So that is kind of the main thing that we know about Indian spirituality at that time. The shaman practices, it is more difficult to know what they were because there aren't any very clear scriptures from the shamans. The only way you can really find out about the shamanical practices is by looking at other scriptures describing them. So it is much more difficult to say anything about. What we can say something about is the Brahmanical meditation, which was similar to Samadhi, unity with Brahma, and the other one is the Jains. The Jains, of course, practicing a bit less clear what exactly they practiced, because they practice more austerities than anything else. Okay. From Florida in the USA, after a good meditation, how can you be sure you felt samadhi during the meditation? So samadhi comes in many degrees, yeah? And what we are trying to really achieve is the more profound the samadhi, the more powerful it is, and the more pregnant it is with insight as a consequence. So really, you just keep on deepening that samadhi, and the way that you know, the ideal samadhi is one where you, the whole world outside of you is completely shut off. You have no perception of the world anymore. You cannot actually hear anything anymore, yeah? You're completely within yourself, very, very happily so. That is the ideal kind of meditation. So this is one of the guiding points taught by the Buddha in the suttas for knowing whether you have attained real samadhi, real jhana, is whether the world has stopped. It is literally said that when you have a jhana experience, you have come to the end of the world. Lokanta, it is called, this particular experience. What world have you come to an end of? The world of the five senses. That is the world you have come to an end of. So this is one way you know that it is really, really profound samadhi. But don't think too much about these things. Don't kind of think about, I want to get there, because sometimes if you think too much about the craving, the desire gets in the way, and then you stop making progress as a consequence. So enjoy what you have. If you already have some samadhi, wonderful. Be so happy about that. If you're already heading in the right way, you're finding some peace, you're finding some happiness in a meditation, what a wonderful thing that is. And as you are happy with that, as you are content with that, that contentment itself will foster even deeper states of meditation. Contentment leads to more contentment, to deeper peace, deeper stillness, and all of these things. Last one is from Germany here. I used to achieve samadhi, but after an upper lung operation, I cannot. Any advice? You can. Yeah, you can. Sorry. You can, even though you had a lung operation, you can, I'm sure, if you just apply yourself in the right way. Yeah, and maybe if you have a problem with the breath because you have a lung operation, you can try another object of meditation. Try the metta. Metta, the loving kindness, can take you also all the way to deep samadhi if you practice it in the right way. So if there is a problem with the breath, try that. And in fact, you can also sometimes, all you need to do sometimes is to think about the Dhamma, think about the Buddha in the right way. That will give rise to bliss. And when that bliss arises, you turn to that and you allow that to take you into deeper meditation. So try one of the other meditation subjects. Metta is a wonderful one to do, if you can, and see if that works instead. Yeah, you had a lung operation. One of the great things about having a lung operation is that you start to feel a bit more concerned about the impermanence of life. Yeah, it is unreliable. You don't know how long it's going to last. So remember that, and that will help you to let go a little bit of this world. You're going to die. We're all going to die one day anyway. Because we're going to die, now is a good time to get ready for that. And as you get ready for it now, it's easy to let go. If it's easy to let go, the meditation becomes more profound. Okay, that is all for tonight. Everyone, no more questions? Everyone happy? Okay, so let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.